Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this call. This is going to be the first of a number of calls we'll be doing all during the week. Starting tomorrow, we'll send you an announcement, but we likely will be doing these at 11 a.m. every day for the next few days. And we're not sure how long we're going to be doing this, but we have no idea how long this crisis is going to continue. In any case, I have three guests here today on the phone. We are, as you know, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we've been a nuclear industry watchdog on security and safety issues for 40 years. I just want to note that we are not for or against nuclear power, but we have grave concerns about the industry both here and abroad. In any case, the three folks that we have on the call today will be speaking about what we know as of now with the events on the ground. We do not know, we're not privy to any up-to-the-minute reports out of Japan any more than you are. We're dealing with what we know because we don't have anyone on the ground down there. And we will be talking about what we know as of now about what is going on with the reactors that are in trouble in Japan. We'll be talking about the threat that they pose to the public health and the environment. And we'll also talk a little bit about the potential ramifications of this crisis on the nuclear industry in the United States. Our first speaker is David Lockbaum, who is a nuclear engineer. Dave is the director of our nuclear safety program. He spent 17 years working for the nuclear industry and has worked on nuclear power plants similar to the ones that are having these problems in Japan. And he has also worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Dave will be followed by Dr. Edwin Lyman, who is a physicist here at our Global Security Program. He's an expert in nuclear plant design and will speak somewhat about the environmental health effects of radiation. And he will be followed by Ellen Vanko, who is UCS's Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager. Ellen was in the utility industry for 25 years and has deep knowledge about nuclear economics and the future, and we'll be talking about the potential impact on nuclear power in the United States. I turn you over to Dave Lockbaum, our first speaker.
Thank you, Elliot, and good afternoon, everybody. The three reactors at the Fukushima nuclear plant are in a situation largely because of the primary problem that they faced was a loss of power. The earthquake knocked out their normal supply of power for safety equipment, and then within an hour, the tsunami knocked out the backup array of power, which was emergency diesel generators, which left all three units dealing with safety equipment powered simply from batteries. When the batteries were depleted, their amount of options they had for core cooling dissipated. Pretty much they were left with no options. That started all three reactors pretty much down the same pathway, where because of inadequate cooling, the reactor core was eventually uncovered, looks like for all three units. As a result of that, there's very clear signs that hydrogen gas was generated on units 1 and 3, that hydrogen gas later ignited and did considerable damage to the reactor building that used to enclose the reactor containment buildings. Right now, the focus of efforts and the prime concern seems to be with the Unit 2 reactor. That reactor also has a problem with core cooling. All three reactors were dealing with the inadequate cooling situation by pumping in seawater to fill up the reactor vessel initially and then to try to fill up the containment to provide a large body of water to absorb the heat being emitted by the reactor cores. On units 1 and 3, those efforts were ultimately successful, and those reactors seem to be trending towards a more stable condition and increasing safety margins with time. On Unit 2, the injection of seawater reportedly ran into problems. It seems like the problem that they faced was the pressure inside the reactor vessel was rose to the point where the pumps were unable to overcome that pressure and get the water to where it needed to go. On all three reactors, there've been reports of reactor damage, the core being uncovered, and certain levels of reactor damage. It's very difficult to determine, for the company to determine the levels of core damage that may have occurred, for no other reason than the initial loss of power took away a lot of the instrumentation that's used to monitor conditions within the reactor containment and the reactor core. And so that with the instrumentation they have left, it's difficult to get a clear picture of what's going on, and it's equally difficult for the government and the company to report exactly on what's going on in there. For example, in this country, after the Three Mile Island accident in March of 1979, it really wasn't until 1983 when the officials dropped a camera into the reactor, or lower camera into the reactor vessel, that it was confirmed that there had been a partial core meltdown. There's not an annunciator, there's not an alarm window or a computer printout that tells you I've experienced core meltdown. So it's something that you kind of figure out after the fact, and they're not there yet. All three reactors, they're attempting to bring the reactors to what's called a cold shutdown condition. That's a situation where the reactor core is shut down, the nuclear chain reaction has been interrupted, and the temperature of the water circulating through the core has been lowered to less than boiling point, or 212 degrees. All three reactors have a ways to go to achieve that. That is not an inherently safe condition, but it's a stable condition, and it gives them as much margin as possible should further equipment failures be encountered, or should damage result from subsequent aftershocks. Unit 2 is the one that's, as I indicated earlier, is the reactor that's most furthest away from that condition. That's the one that's got in the most dire situation right now. But beyond that, it's difficult to project what will happen or what won't happen. But we'll try to keep monitoring and update anything we know tomorrow. Okay, thanks, Elliot.
Thank you, Dave. Our next speaker is Dr. Edwin Lyman.
Thank you, Elliot. I'd just like to discuss, in a general way, the consequence of events, or the sequence of events, should core cooling not be restored to Unit 2, or should Units 1 and 3 experience interruptions that once again uncover the core. The core uncovery, if there's no attempt to mitigate it, will lead to overheating and core melt within a matter of hours. Now, the nuclear fuel is uranium pellets that are stacked and then contained in zirconium metal rods. When core damage occurred at Units 1 and 3, the first indication was the reaction of zirconium, hot zirconium with coolant, which generated hydrogen, which then was one possible source of the hydrogen that led to the explosions. Also, the presence of the fission products, iodine-131, cesium-137, could have been indicators that the fuel rods, or some fuel rods, had ruptured. And that's not an indication that the fuel pellets themselves had begun melting yet, because in normal operation, there is some accumulation of fission product gases between the pellets and the cladding, which is called the gap fraction, and there may have been an indication that the gap fractions had been released. That would be on the order of 5% of the total inventory of those isotopes in the fuel. If the core melts completely, it loses its shape and collapses and would fall to the bottom of the reactor vessel, which is steel. Now, modeling shows, and tests that have been done at Sandia National Laboratories have confirmed that that is a condition that could lead to vessel melt-through, where the molten core will actually corrode through the steel liner through the steel vessel and then drop to the concrete floor of the containment building. Once that happens, the ability to contain the accident is greatly reduced, because the core is liquefied and it then flows out, it spreads across the floor. In the Mark I containment, there is a known vulnerability to containment failure known as a liner melt through, that if that melt spreads to the corners, then it may be able to melt through the steel shell of the containment as it ate through the reactor vessel. And in that case, because especially since the secondary containment, the reactor buildings have been severely damaged, that would essentially mean a large radiological release to the environment. At that point, the magnitude of the release would depend on a number of factors. It's very hard to predict, but it could potentially be large scale and on the order of what we saw at Chernobyl.
Okay, thank you, Ed. Our next speaker is Ellen Vanko.
Many people are asking whether the events in Japan will affect the nuclear renaissance in the United States. While it's premature to start making such predictions, it would be naive to think that this event will have no impact on the nuclear industry in this country. The first impact will likely be seen at existing reactors. A thorough assessment is needed to ensure that these reactors are being operated as safely and securely as possible, that existing NRC regulations and NERC reliability standards in effect today governing plant operations and safety are fully enforced. We also need to ensure that any improvements to those regulations and standards are identified and implemented. The nuclear industry was in trouble in the United States long before last week's earthquake and tsunami. Spiraling construction cost estimates, declining energy demand, low natural gas costs, and the failure to put a price on carbon already spell trouble for this industry. Just last week, John Rowe, chairman and CEO of the largest nuclear company in this country, told the American Enterprise Institute that he would not invest in new reactors because they're uneconomic compared to other low-carbon alternatives like energy efficiency, natural gas, and power uprates at existing reactors. One lesson we can draw from the unfolding disaster in Japan is that no matter how technologically advanced we are as a society, and Japan certainly is, it is impossible to fully plan for every curveball Mother Nature can throw at us or to prevent catastrophic damage from affecting critical infrastructure, including roads, bridges, power plants, and telecommunication systems. While it's critical to address those problems, our concerns and sympathy rest with the people of Japan, both those who have been affected by multiple disasters as well as those who might be in the coming days and months. This doesn't mean, however, that we should not put in place all practical mechanisms to protect our citizens and environment from known hazards that could occur if nuclear reactors are not planned and operated in a safe and secure manner. Utilities, police, and fire departments and other first responders must be fully prepared to address not only a nuclear accident, but a combination of disruptive events, natural or otherwise, that could precipitate a nuclear accident. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.